Chapter 41. In a meeting in January 2018, Navarro, Ross, Cohn, and Porter gathered in the Oval Office. After months of arguing about tariffs from entrenched positions, debates had become heated and sharp. Cohn, backed by Porter, rehashed the economic arguments and the geopolitical national security arguments. He talked about how tariffs risked roiling the markets and jeopardizing a lot of the stock market gains. He said the tariffs would be, in effect, a tax on American consumers. Tariffs would take away a lot of the good that Trump had done through tax and regulatory reform. "You're the globalist," Trump said. "I don't even care what you think anymore, Gary." Trump shooed him away. Cohn retreated to a couch. Navarro and Porter picked up the debate, with Ross interjecting on Navarro's side from time to time. Navarro argued that tariffs would raise revenues and be beloved by businesses and unions. He said it would be a great way for Trump to get union support and help his base in advance of the 2018 midterm election. Porter brought up the Bush tariffs and the net job loss that had occurred. In the years since, Porter argued, downstream industries that consumed and relied on steel, builders and pipelines and the auto industry, had expanded, while there was little potential for expansion of steel manufacturing and production jobs. The job losses under new tariffs would be even more pronounced than the ones during the Bush administration. Porter said Navarro's belief that tariffs would be met with widespread acclaim was just dead wrong. Many businesses would oppose tariffs because they were buyers and consumers of steel. "The automakers are going to hate this," Porter said. "They have narrow margins, and this is going to raise their costs. Pipeline makers, too. We're opening up all these new federal public lands and offshore drilling. It requires people building pipelines." "And the unions," Porter said. "Well, that's crazy. Sure, the steel union is going to love this, but the United Auto Workers isn't going to like this. The building and construction trades isn't going to like this. It's going to up their costs." Porter ordinarily tried to remain an honest broker who facilitated the discussion. When he had a strong view, he tended to wait until he was one-on-one with the president. Now he was outing himself as a free trader. Navarro countered each argument as strenuously as Porter made it. Chief of Staff John Kelly walked into the room midway through the meeting. The president was watching the back and forth avidly. "What are you, an economist now?" Trump asked Porter after he and Navarro had taken verbal swings at each other for nearly half an hour. "What do you know about economics? You're a lawyer." Porter said he had studied and tutored others in economics while he was at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. He pointed out that many of his arguments weren't strictly economic. "I always knew Gary was a fucking globalist," Trump said. "I didn't know you were such a fucking globalist, Rob." Trump turned to Kelly. "Get a load of this guy. He's a globalist." Kelly nodded and smiled. He wanted this meeting wrapped up. The meeting broke up without a real resolution, except to remind Trump that he had signed a decision memo to move forward on the 301 investigation with China and announced it. That had to come before steel tariffs. That was the strategy and agreement. Porter left the White House on February 7th after two ex-wives went public with allegations that he had physically abused them. One released a photo showing a black eye that she said Porter gave her. Each, one to the press and one in a blog post, gave graphic descriptions of domestic abuse. Porter quickly concluded it would be best for all, his former spouses, his family and close friends, the White House and himself, to resign. He wanted to focus on repairing relationships and healing. The New York Times wrote, "Abuse claims and stars rise in White House," and "AIDS clean-cut image belied his hot temper," former colleagues say. In a statement, Porter said, "I took the photos given to the media nearly 15 years ago, and the reality behind them is nowhere close to what is being described." People's lives are being shattered and destroyed by a mere allegation, Trump tweeted. The Washington Post editorial board accused the White House of shrugging off domestic violence, and the New York Times said, Trump appears to doubt the hashtag MeToo movement. Cohn saw that one of the main restraining influences on Trump was now gone. After 6:30 on the night of Wednesday, February 28th, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro went to the Oval Office and convinced the president to move ahead with steel tariffs before the 301 investigation was complete, imploding the whole trade strategy. Ross had earlier produced a study maintaining that the rising imports of steel and aluminum were a threat to the national security, giving Trump the authority to impose them without Congress. Ross and Navarro had arranged for the main U.S. steel executives to come to the White House the next day. When Cohn got word of the plan, he called Kelly around 10 p.m. I don't know anything about a meeting, Kelly said. There's no meeting. Oh, there's a meeting. What are you talking about, Gary? Cohn tried to kill the meeting, and for a while he thought he had succeeded. But then it was back on. More than a dozen executives showed up the next day. At a meeting in the cabinet room, Trump announced that he had decided to impose a 25% tariff on foreign-made steel and 10% on aluminum. You will have protection for the first time in a long while, Trump told the executives, and you're going to regrow your industries, he said, even though all the data Cohn had gathered showed it was not practical or even possible. Cohn believed if they had completed the work on the intellectual property case against China, they would have had the allies on board for a blockbuster trade case. It would have been most of the world against China. Their economic rival would be isolated. Steel tariffs upended all of that. Cohn concluded that Trump just loved to pit people against each other. The president had never been in a business where he had to do long-term strategic thinking. He went to see Trump to explain that he was resigning. If this is the way you're going to run the place, Cohn said, he was going to leave. I can deal with losing a battle in the White House as long as we follow proper protocol and procedure. But when two guys get to walk in your office at 6:30 at night and schedule a meeting that the chief of staff and no one knows about, I can't work in that environment. Cohn knew the importance of Hope Hicks, who had been elevated to White House Communications Director. Cohn often asked her to join him when he was heading into a tough conversation with Trump, saying, Hope, come on in with me. He found Hicks softened the president and that Trump treated Cohn differently when she was there. On Tuesday, March 6th, he went to see Hicks. They crafted a statement for the president to issue with Cohn's resignation. Gary has been my chief economic advisor and did a superb job in driving our agenda, helping to deliver historic tax cuts and reforms, and unleashing the American economy once again. He is a rare talent, and I thank him for his dedicated service to the American people. They fiddled with the language, then took a printed copy into the Oval Office. They took seats at the Resolute desk. Mr. President, Cohn said, today's probably the right day for me to put out my resignation. Gary's been so great, Hicks said, soothing the moment. We're going to miss him so much. This is a shame. We've got to find a way to bring him back. Of course, the president said. We're going to bring him back. It was a false show to the end. Cohn realized again what he had said before to others about the president. He's a professional liar. I've got a quote here that I've okayed with Gary, Hicks said. I want you to okay it. Trump took the piece of paper and tweaked a word, but otherwise let the statement stand. It's a huge loss, Trump said, but we'll be fine, and he's coming back. Gary Cohn to resign as Trump advisor after dispute over tariffs, Bloomberg reported. Gary Cohn resigns amid differences with Trump on trade, said the Washington Post. Gary Cohn resigns, apparently over tariffs, read The Atlantic. Gary Cohn resigns as White House economic advisor after losing tariffs fight, said the Wall Street Journal. Later, after he resigned, Cohn worried about instability in the economy that would come from tariffs and the impact on the consumer. The U.S. is a consumer-driven economy, and if the consumer is unsure of what the economy will look like and what their disposable income will look like, that will be seen very quickly in the economy and in the stock market. Trump's action and mounting threats on tariffs were jarring. Cohn thought that Trump had to know. But he's not man enough to admit it. He's never been wrong yet. He's 71. He's not going to admit he's wrong, ever. Tom Bossert, the president's advisor for Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Counterterrorism, went to the Oval Office in the spring of 2018 and found Trump in his private dining room. "Sir, do you have a minute?" Bossert, a 43-year-old lawyer and security expert, asked. "I want to watch the Masters," Trump said. He had TiVo'd the Augusta National Golf Club tournament, the most famous in the world, and was glued to it. Bossert, another high-flying aide with Oval Office access, even in the Kelly era, invited himself to sit down and watch. The lawyer knew the United States was already in a constant state of low-intensity cyber war with advanced foreign adversaries such as China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. These countries had the ability to shut down the power grid in the United States cities, for example, and the only deterrent was to make clear that a massive cyber attack would not just be met with cyber for cyber symmetry. The full force of the U.S. military, including nuclear weapons, would have to be a central part of the deterrent. Bossert liked to say, and he said it regularly, that the use of any element of national power would be justified. The United States had too much to lose in a high-consequence cyber attack. Bossert had repeated it so often that the president seemed to understand, but the import of this, nuclear weapons as a cyber deterrent, had not quite become part of the public debate. "What's going on?" Trump finally asked. "I'm coming at you one more time," Bossert said. "I'm going to do TV, the upcoming ABC Sunday show this week. But this China trade issue is going to come up again. So would cyber." "You and your cyber," Trump said, "are going to get me in a war with all your cyber shit." "That's the point, sir. I'm trying to use other elements of national power to prevent bad behavior online. And that's going to put me right in the middle of all of the decisions you're making. That's why I'm here. You're now in the middle of a personal negotiation with President Xi. You just upped the ante to $150 billion in tariff threats with China." "Fine. How do you want me to handle it on TV? I don't want to go out and say something that's going to then piss you off." Trump jumped at the invitation to provide some television coaching, to mainline some performance wisdom. It was pure delight. "So here's how you do it," Trump said, his fingers flying in the air. "Tom, are you ready? You go up there, you say..." He wanted to formulate it just right. "You tell them you've never seen..." "No, wait. First you tell them, Trump's dead serious. That's what you tell them. Are you ready?" Trump's hands and fingers went up again. "You tell them $150 billion. Wait, you tell them $150 billion is nothing. He's ready to go to $500 billion because he's tired of not being treated fairly. That's what you tell them." Trump continued with animated fingers. "You ready? That's what you tell them." "Okay," Bossert said. "You want me to go hard?" "You go hard," Trump said with enthusiasm. "If it weren't for Sunday, you'd shut the markets down. That's how fucking hard you fucking go." Fingers up again. "Hold on, wait. Then you say, don't worry about it. See here, watch. Here's what you do." Trump offered some stage direction, one hand up again for dramatic emphasis. "Then you say, it'll be all right because the relationship Trump has with Xi is so..." A pause. A refinement. It's the best. Wait. You've never seen such a good relationship between two presidents in your life. Maybe ever. Are you ready? The president asked. Bossert thought he would remember the script and the Trump show, perhaps for the rest of his life. It was Trump's way of saying, go hard. Trump's willing to go to the mat. We're being treated unfairly. And don't worry about soybeans, Trump said. The Chinese had announced they would retaliate with tariffs on American agriculture and other goods. Speaking in the third person, Trump said, he'll buy more goddamn soybeans if Trump has to. He'll buy his own damn soybeans from his own farmers before the Chinese push him around. But then you tell them, it'll be all right. He and Xi will work out a deal. It'll be a beautiful deal, the best deal you've ever seen. So you want me to go hard and soft? Bossert now asked. Hard on determination and soft on the relationship with Xi. Yeah. Bossert raised cyber again. Oh, for Christ's sake, Trump said. If you have to hit the cyber thing, fine. Bossert saw that Trump wanted him to stick to trade. Boss, here's how I do it. It's a trade dispute. It's not a trade war. There's a trade deficit. In the 80s, we had a trade dispute with Japan, and we were close allies with them at the same time. Perfect, Trump said. You got it. You throw that crap in there, sounds good, then you tell them what I said, and then you're good. Apparently, trying to tamp down any anxiety, he added, Tom, you'll be fine. Afterward, Bossert stuck his head in Kelly's office just as a courtesy to say he had just been prepping for TV with the president and had nothing unusual to report. Kelly waved him off. It seemed to Bossert that the chief of staff was greatly diminished, resigned, and had largely given up. Bossert was ready with his talking points, but on ABC, host Martha Raddatz focused on border security. Trump had said he wanted to send 2,000 to 4,000 National Guard troops to the southern border. It was the topic of the day, driven by Trump's comment. She never asked about China. Bossert was disappointed because he was ready to pass along the president's message of determination and the extraordinary bonding with President Xi of China. Chapter 42. The rest of February, Dowd didn't hear much. He thought Mueller and Quarles were slow rolling it. A meeting was finally arranged for 2 p.m. on Monday, March 5th at Mueller's office. Mueller was accompanied by Quarles and three other prosecutors. Dowd came with Seculo and another lawyer. It quickly became clear that they had different views about the purpose of the meeting. Well, Mueller said, I guess that's it. What are you talking about? Dowd asked. Where are the questions? You know, I don't know, Mueller said, a poker player in mid-game. Jim said that's what was going to happen here. Well, you know, I don't know, Mueller said again. Seems to me you're not going to testify. Under the circumstances, exactly right. Well, you know, Mueller said, I could always get a grand jury subpoena. You go right the fuck ahead and get it, Dowd said, striking the table with his hand. I can't wait to file a fucking motion to quash. And I want to hear you tell the U.S. District Judge what the crime is, and I want you to explain. Dowd said Mueller had all the evidence he could possibly need. My motion to quash is going to have everything we've given you, including the testimony of 37 witnesses, including the 1,400,000 documents with the highlights on the most intimate conversations of the president. I want you to tell that judge why you need a grand jury subpoena, which, by the way, has never been issued in the history of the country to any president. And, by the way, there is no president, all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who's ever been so transparent. Dowd continued, You want to go to war? Let's go to war. And by the way, I will tell the president that you have now threatened us with a grand jury subpoena. So, Mr. President, if you don't testify, I'm going to haul your ass in front of the public and we're going to have a grand jury subpoena. We're going to have a hearing. And by the way, Bob, none of this evidence is before the grand jury. So I want you to explain that to the federal judge, why none of this is before his or her grand jury yet. Dowd believed all the main evidence was in the interviews and documents, and only in rare cases had that sort of evidence been presented to the grand jury. "John, it's okay," Mueller said, trying to calm Dowd. "Bob, you threatened the President of the United States with a grand jury subpoena when he's not a target, and barely a subject. He's essentially a goddamn witness, and I'm going to tell the judge that. So he has no criminal liability as of March 5th, 2018, the date they were meeting. Nothing. And I'm going to tell the judge I'm not going to let you play gotcha. I'm not going to have you start testing the recollection of this president over something that there is no crime. And Bob, I've asked you. You're the one that wanted to engage. Talk about reciprocity. You guys tell me where the collusion is, and don't give me that chicken shit meeting in June," Dowd said, referring to Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer in Trump Tower. "That's nothing. There's no collusion. And the obstruction? It's a joke. Obstruction's a joke. Flynn? I mean, Yates and Comey didn't think he lied. And by the way, he told, in the memo of the White House counsel, he told them the agents had said they closed his file. I mean, Flynn believed that he had no jeopardy. Yeah, none." Dowd continued, "I can't wait to read your papers. Well, my papers are going first. And by the way, just give me the subpoena. I'll take it." "John," Mueller said, "I'm not trying to threaten you. I'm just thinking of the possibilities here." Dowd pivoted to the good old boy approach. "The other possibility is, give me the questions. We have a relationship of mutual trust. We've trusted you guys. You've trusted us. And we've never failed you. Bob, isn't really the important thing that you get whatever the truth is? And you've got us working for you." Dowd decided to take an extraordinary step. "I have no secrets with you guys," Dowd said. "I'm going to tell you about my conversation with the President of the United States on the subject of testimony." He mentioned three of the questions he had taken Trump through up in the White House residence. On the third, he had no clue. He just made something up. That's his nature. Dowd realized he had Mueller's full attention. "Jay," he said to Sekulow, "you play the president, I'll play Mueller, okay?" They would role-play what Dowd had witnessed with the president. "Let's talk about Comey." Dowd asked about one of Trump's Comey conversations. Sekulow's answer was classic Trump, an answer spun out of thin air with contradictions, made-up stuff, anger. A perfect performance. A perfect Trump. "Gotcha. Gotcha. 1001. Dowd said, slamming the table, referring to the section of the U.S. Code that deals with false statements. "Gotcha. 1001. Dowd asked another simple question of Sekulow, still playing Trump. "I don't know," Sekulow said. "I don't know. I don't know." "Jay," Dowd said, "how many times did he say, 'I don't know,' when we talked to him?" "Oh, a dozen? 20? "Bob," Dowd said to Mueller, "here's my point. You're asking me to sit next to a president who'll get to the third question, screw it up, and thereafter, because I'm going to counsel him, he just doesn't know and he doesn't remember. So he's going to say, 'I don't remember,' 20 times. And I'm telling you, Bob, he doesn't remember. And by the way, if you'd like, I will get General Kelly in here to tell you he doesn't remember. And the reason he doesn't remember is very simple. One, these facts and these events are of little moment in his life. Most had taken place early in his presidency. All of a sudden, he's the boss. But he's getting information from all quarters, including the media, every day. That is like tonnage. And the fact is, I don't want him looking like an idiot. And I'm not going to sit there and let him look like an idiot, and you publish that transcript because everything leaks in Washington, and the guys overseas are going to say, 'I told you he was an idiot. I told you he was a goddamn dumbbell. What are we dealing with that idiot for? He can't even remember XYZ with respect to his FBI director.'" Dowd was aware that he had illustrated the president was clearly disabled. "John, I understand," Mueller said. Well, Bob, what do you want to know? Give me one question that no one has answered. Well, I want to know if he had corrupt intent. Bob, do you think he's going to say yes? Because on his behalf, I'm telling you no. And if you want me to get an affidavit from the president that he had no corrupt intent, I'll give it to you. Let me think about it, Mueller said. I hate to think that you would be playing us. Wait a minute, Dowd said. Give me a fucking break. I've got a track record here that is unimpeachable. You ask Jim Quarles if I've ever played him. Is there anything that I've ever said to you that wasn't correct? No, Quarles answered. John's one of the best lawyers we deal with. Dowd began to think that Mueller didn't know the facts of the case. Under the joint defense agreement with some 37 witnesses, Dowd had received debriefings from the lawyers for them. Did anyone lie? Dowd asked. No, Mueller said. Did anyone destroy documents? No, Mueller said. Am I right that you want good, reliable answers? Yes. Get me the questions, Dowd said, and I will take them and tell you whether we can answer them. He would provide the answers, a line or two to each question. Fair swap, he continued. You give me the questions, so I know what's on your mind. General Kelly could get Mueller, his team, and a court reporter into the White House without anyone knowing. We'll have a script. The president would be under oath. We'll get it just the way we want it, but we're telling you that's the truth as we know it. The president's saying that's the truth as he knows it with the assistance of counsel. So either that, or you sit there while we interrupt him for 6 hours, or he plays, I don't know. Mueller's team were shaking their heads and made it clear that had never been done before. No way. It was unheard of. Let me think about whether to give you some questions, Mueller said. Dowd reminded Mueller that in July or August, when Trump had attacked Mueller and Sessions, Mueller had contacted Dowd to say, I got a problem. Can you come by? You said I got people refusing to testify that don't need to refuse to testify. They don't have any culpability at all. But I'm afraid that the atmosphere, they feel like they're disloyal if they testify. And Dowd had told him, well, I'll go public and say we want everyone to cooperate. The president's cooperating. We're cooperating 100%, and we encourage everyone to do that. Dowd and Cobb had been quoted in the press saying Trump and the White House would continue to fully cooperate. As he had at each meeting, Dowd said, what's at stake is the country. The president needed to do his job and did not have time for this investigation. There were serious, even dramatic tensions in the world. North Korea, Iran, the Middle East, Russia, China. I'm very sensitive to that, Mueller replied. I'm doing the best I can. Why don't you just give us the questions? Dowd pressed. Mueller didn't like it. Dowd knew he was gambling and daring Mueller by threatening to fight a grand jury subpoena. That was his design, sending a message that if Mueller wanted to go the grand jury route, this was what it would look like. He would fill his motions with exhibits, and the district judge would spend 2 weeks reading them. Dowd had laid it out as strongly as he could to Mueller. And you're going to have to stand in the well of the court and tell the judge why you want to put the President of the United States in the grand jury. Bob, as you know, I've handled cases like this, and I wouldn't go near the grand jury with the President of the United States. He had a final argument. The perjury trap was what Mueller's team did, he charged. You did it to Flynn, you did it to Gates, you did it to George Papadopoulos, a former campaign aide. You guys, that's the games you played. Rick Gates, a Manafort business associate and Trump's deputy campaign chairman, had one of the best lawyers sitting next to him and had still lied. You guys gave him no time to prepare, and now he's got a felony. Bob, that's exactly what I told the president. That's what they're going to do to you in an interview. Dowd thought it possible, even likely, that there was something he didn't know. Bob, you guys are all wound up about something. There must be something here. Maybe you disapprove of the president's behavior. But you don't have a case. Whatever they had, Dowd said, go tell it to the mountain and go tell it to the hill. I don't care. Mueller sat stone-faced, marble, non-responsive. Such control. The meeting was over. At 5 p.m., Dowd and Sekulo went to see the president in the dining room off the Oval Office. How did it go? Trump asked. Mr. President, Dowd said, this is ridiculous. Oh, my God, Trump said. Dowd's reaction to the Mueller meeting seemed so negative that Trump looked worried that he was now really in trouble. No, Dowd said. You've never truly respected Mueller. You got really good instincts, but I've never bought into it. But I've got to tell you, I think your instincts might be right. He really wasn't prepared. Why are we coming back here with nothing? A week later, March 12th, Dowd and his team went again to see Mueller and his team. He hoped against hope that Mueller was going to say he was inclined to decline prosecution and say he needed the president's testimony just to write a report to Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. Mueller's team, Quarles, and three others dictated 49 questions, and Jay Sekulo took notes. Nearly all concerned Trump's attitude, opinions, decision-making, or conclusions about major players such as Flynn, Comey, and Sessions. Some inquired about Donald Jr. and the famous meeting at Trump Tower and the offer from a Russian lawyer to provide dirt on Hillary Clinton. Others concerned real estate development in Russia. The broad range of subjects validated what the news was reporting on what Mueller was investigating. This is horseshit, Dowd thought. Second-year law school questions. Many had been answered. To have Trump answer them, of course, would be a catastrophe because Trump could erupt and say absolutely anything. On one level, Dowd thought the broad range of questions suggested that Mueller had nothing and wanted to go on a giant fishing expedition. Setting a perjury trap for the volatile Trump would be child's play. There's no case here, Dowd told Mueller. I need the president's testimony, Mueller said. What was his intent on Comey? I'm not sure constitutionally you can question that, Dowd told him. Article 2 powers of the president were long acknowledged, even by Comey. I want to see if there was corrupt intent, Mueller said again. This was the very heart of the matter. The obstruction statutes did not make specific acts alone unlawful. The acts had to be done corruptly or willfully with the intent of obstructing justice. State of mind was the key. Why had the president acted the way he had? That was why Mueller wanted the president's testimony, Dowd believed. Do you have some evidence that he was paid off? Dowd asked. Payment for illegal action, suborning perjury or destroying evidence, are normally the elements needed to show obstruction. Tapes, sworn testimony of a witness, or documents are the best evidence, unless the prosecutors had it out of the mouth of the subject of the investigation, unless someone torpedoed himself, as Dowd was certain the president would do. Your own deputy attorney general is a witness for the president, Dowd said. Rosenstein had written the memo urging that Comey be fired for his conduct in the Clinton email case. Matter of fact, he, Rosenstein, took the president's 4-page letter and rewrote it. I rest my case. Then you've got the attorney general. Then you've got the vice president. Then you've got McGahn. Everybody around the president. And then you've got Comey's behavior, which both the deputy and the AG had condemned in the Clinton case. Intent? Dowd continued. All the documents and testimony answer that. You asked witnesses what he, the president, said and what he did and when he did it. I submit all that stuff is in real time. That was all that was needed to show the president's intent. Mueller was not buying. Dowd and Sekulo left the building. What do you think? Sekulo asked. He ain't testifying, Dowd said. It had been a complete fantasy to think that Mueller would decline prosecution. Dowd believed he could use the Court of Appeals decision in the independent counsel investigation of Bill Clinton's Agriculture Secretary, Mike Espy. The court had ruled that executive privilege applied to the president and to his advisors. Prosecutors who wanted to overcome the privilege must show the materials sought contain important evidence that isn't available elsewhere. The court ruled that prosecutors had to show a matter under investigation was a serious crime and that no one other than the subpoenaed witness could answer. Dowd and Sekulo reported back to Trump. I have a completely different picture of Mueller now, Dowd told Trump. The president had been right. I don't trust him. The 49 questions troubled Dowd. Why not just five? Why no deference to the President of the United States, who didn't have time to prepare and then answer questions in the middle of so many world problems? Dowd said this reinforced the decision that the president should not testify. Yeah, Trump said. They got answers to all of them. Cobb began saying publicly that the president really wanted to testify and answer a few questions. Mr. President, Dowd said, it ain't a few. There's 49 of them. That's not my advice. What are people going to say? Trump asked. How's it going to look in the press? Mr. President, it's a trap. They don't have a legal or constitutional reason to talk to you. He mentioned lawyers who had represented Trump in the past. If you don't want to take my word for it, call them. Trump called Dowd from Air Force One later in March. Mr. President, you just need to take my advice, Dowd said. Otherwise, we're going to have a major disaster. There's no way you can get through these. You remember our meeting when you read our letter? You remember you were comfortable? You understood the strategy? Mr. President, we have won this thing hands down. The 49 questions, you agree, have already been answered. You've got people here that answered them. You've got lawyers that answered them. You've got staff. I mean, Priebus, Bannon, all of them gave testimony acceptable to the special counsel. He has no quarrel with it. Mr. President, there's no poison in the well. No one has lied. No documents are missing. There's no president in our history that's done what you've done. Why can't I get you to just be proud of that and sit on it? And, Mr. President, what I recommend is we just make all that public. We politely tell Bob you're not going to sit for an interview for the obvious reasons and for the constitutional reasons, and you're protecting the office for your successors. If you testify, then we're going to go through decades of gotcha and let's get the president under oath. It's just the new game, particularly when there's no crime and no basis, you know? The investigations of Reagan in Iran-Contra, Clinton in Whitewater-Lewinsky, and Nixon in Watergate all involved criminal activity, he said. And by the way, if there was criminal activity where your White House could help out, I have no doubt you would respond, and that you would if someone asked you about someone on your staff that had misbehaved and you witnessed something, you'd be a good witness. You'd testify. But that's not the case here. This is a case where all of the questions have been answered. Mr. President, you're just cutting my legs off. I'm trying to be a good lawyer. You're a good lawyer, Trump said. You're a great lawyer. Mr. President, I cannot, as a lawyer, as an officer of the court, sit next to you and have you answer these questions when I full well know that you're not really capable. Dowd wanted to dress it up as much as possible to say, it's not your fault. It's the burden of the office. He knew in this confrontation he could not be insulting. He could not say what he knew was true. You're a fucking liar. That was the problem. So, Dowd said, you do have trouble staying on the subject, and that can defeat you. Then you try to catch yourself, and you misstate something, and bam. It's like Mike Flynn not remembering the conversation with Kislyak. Once more on Air Force One, Trump called his lawyer. Are you happy? The president asked. No, Dowd said. I'm not happy, Mr. President. This is a goddamn heartbreak. I feel like I failed. I've failed as your lawyer. I've been unable to persuade you to take my advice. I'm no different than a doctor. I know what ails you. I know what your difficulty is. I've given a prescription that I know will keep you out of harm's way. Remember the first rule, Mr. President, is do no harm. That's where we are. And if I go and sit with you and let you do something that I think is bad for you and will get you in further trouble, then I ought to lose my license. Maybe there are lawyers that just sort of blink at all that. I know that. John, I know you're frustrated. I am. I don't mind telling you, I regret the day I ever recommended Ty Cobb, and I can't believe that he undermined me. Well, Trump said, I asked him to speak out and show the president was not afraid to testify. He should have declined. He's a government employee. And by the way, they can call him as a witness. He has no privilege with you. Jesus, Trump said, sounding worried. I've talked a lot with him. I wish I could persuade you, Dowd said. Don't testify. It's either that or an orange jumpsuit. If it's decision time, you're going to go forward. I can't be with you. You're walking away, Trump said. How can you quit on me? It was a matter of principle, Dowd said, and the lawyer's obligation to try to protect his client. I wish you'd stay. You're a great lawyer. Dowd knew it was bullshit, but that was one of the Trump paradoxes. They could have a hell of an argument, but when they were done, on the phone or in person, Trump would say, "Thank you. I appreciate everything you're doing." In a lifetime of law, Dowd maybe had only 5 clients who had so graciously expressed their thanks. Sekulow and Cobb called Dowd to complain that the president was not responding to them, blowing them off. They needed Dowd to call the president. "Mr. President," Dowd said in a call on the night of March 21st around 10 p.m. "Hi, John," the president said. He was very nice, calm. "Mr. President," Dowd said, "I'm sorry to bother you, but Ty and Jay have called me." They wanted him to address the question about testifying. Trump said he had decided to testify. He could handle Mueller. "John, that's just where I am. Sorry you don't agree." "Well, it's not my job to agree. It's my job to look after you, and if you start taking your own advice, you get in trouble. Mr. President, I don't take my own advice." "You have lawyers?" "Absolutely. All the crap I've been through, of course I have lawyers." "John, that's where I'm at," Trump repeated. "I think the President of the United States cannot be seen taking the Fifth." "Mr. President, we can make a far better presentation than that. By the way, I would add something. I think we ought to brief the key leaders on the Hill first before we go public. Take all the testimony and documents and make the case to them before getting involved in a court battle. Tell them why we're not testifying. If we show them all this stuff..." "That's not a bad idea," Trump said. "But John, the guys out there are not going to be happy if I don't testify." He did not say who the guys were, but Dowd knew he meant the Trump base, the crowds at his rallies, the Fox News watchers, the deplorables. What are they going to think when Mueller requests an indictment for 1001 violations? Dowd asked, referring to false statements. No, I'm a good witness. I'll be a real good witness." Dowd knew this was self-delusion, total bullshit. He had earlier told the president an anecdote from a lawyer friend in Florida who had once taken Trump's deposition. When the lawyer had asked him what he did for a living, it had taken Trump about 16 pages to answer the question. "You are not a good witness," Dowd said again. "Some people simply were not." Dowd offered an example. "Mr. President, you remember Raj Rajaratnam?" "The hedge fund guy," Trump recalled. Dowd had represented Rajaratnam, the billionaire founder of Galleon Group, who was found guilty in 2011 of insider trading and sentenced to 11 years in prison. "Brilliant guy," Dowd said. "If you just sat down at a table and talked to him, you'd say, He was one of the most gifted, eloquent guys I ever met. He can talk about anything. Mr. President, when I got him ready to testify just for 5 minutes on a motion, he wet himself. He suddenly became so nervous, I mean, he couldn't. And then, when I got him on direct, he could barely answer his own name. It's just the nature of the beast, and I am an expert in that beast. Mr. President, I'm afraid I just can't help you, Dowd said. He told the president he had every right to be pissed off at Mueller. They're not going to impeach you. Are you shitting me? They're a bunch of cowards, the whole town. The media, the Congress, they're gutless. What's the impeachment going to be? For exercising Article 2? Huh? Hello? Hello, I want to hear Speaker Ryan take that one up before the Rules Committee and the Judiciary Committee. It is the press, Trump said. They're kicking the crap out of me. Mr. President, you're the one that didn't give up your tax returns. You've already won round one. They're sore as hell. They hate you. They hate your guts. What does the press want? Trump asked. I'd pull all their credentials. I'd throw them the fuck out of there. I don't think they have any right to come into the White House and behave the way they do. Trump said that was his sentiment. But I always get overruled, John. They, Hope Hicks and Kelly, overrule me every time I want to pull someone's credentials. The press, Mueller, Congress, Dowd said. We ought to tell them to go fuck themselves, and let's get back to being President of the United States. Because compared to what you do every day, this is a gnat on an elephant's ass, and we've got to treat it that way and get going. Dowd considered it his closing argument. You're a great guy, Trump said. I thank you. I'm sorry to keep you up so late. The next morning, Dowd told his wife Carol, I'm gone. He called the president and said he was resigning. I'm sorry I am resigning. I love you. I back you. And I wish you the very best, but if you're not going to take my advice, I cannot represent you. I understand your frustration, the president said. You've done a great job. Mr. President, anything else I can do for you, call me anytime. Thank you. 2 minutes later, the New York Times called Dowd, and the Washington Post called. Dowd could see Trump picking up the phone and imagined him calling Maggie Haberman at the Times. Maggie? Fucking Dowd just resigned. Trump always liked to be the first to deliver the news. At least Dowd felt he'd gotten ahead of it, had resigned before being fired and getting his ass trashed. Dowd remained convinced that Mueller never had a Russian case or an obstruction case. He was looking for the perjury trap. And in a brutally honest self-evaluation, he believed that Mueller had played him and the president for suckers in order to get their cooperation on witnesses and documents. Dowd was disappointed in Mueller pulling such a sleight of hand. After 47 years, Dowd knew the game, knew prosecutors. They built cases. With all the testimony and documents, Mueller could string together something that would look bad. Maybe they had something new and damning, as he now more than half suspected. Maybe some witness like Flynn had changed his testimony. Things like that happened, and that could change the ballgame dramatically. Former top aide comes clean, admits to lying, turns on the president. Dowd didn't think so, but he had to worry and consider the possibility. Some things were clear, and many were not, in such a complex, tangled investigation. There was no perfect X-ray, no tapes, no engineer's drawing. Dowd believed that the president had not colluded with Russia or obstructed justice. But in the man and his presidency, Dowd had seen the tragic flaw. In the political back and forth, the evasions, the denials, the tweeting, the obscuring, crying fake news, the indignation, Trump had one overriding problem that Dowd knew but could not bring himself to say to the president. You're a fucking liar. Fear, Trump in the White House, was written by Bob Woodward and read by Robert Petkoff. The recording was engineered by Catherine Cook at CDM Studios and James Yost at Reservoir Studios in New York City. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions and Common Mode. The music mix was by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Fear, Trump in the White House, was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Fear, Trump in the White House, is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.